Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Bratfeld, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The matter that we have on our calendar today is A210115. It's in re the estate of Mark Kevin Egan. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And we appreciate you participating in this Zoom session in light of our COVID pandemic. And we're all learning how to do it correctly. But I think we get better and better at it as we do it. So with that being said, I believe the appellant may proceed at this time.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Westrick. I represent the appellant, Molly Egan. The principal issue that I want to bring to the court's attention today involves the fact that the trial court inexplicably went and made a decision on an issue which was not presented to it by the parties. That is the issue of whether or not the last beneficiary form was obtained by undue influence. The trial court's own conclusions of law make clear that there were two issues. The first issue was the signature genuine, which the court found was, and the court noticed that the second issue identified by the parties is whether or not the decedent possessed sufficient capacity. And the court found that it was his signature, and the court found that the decedent did have capacity. Then later on, as the court goes through all of the matter, the court decides that there was undue influence. He doesn't use the term undue influence, but he does use the language which indicates undue influence, meaning where he found that the last beneficiary form reflected Molly Egan's intent and not that of the decedent's.
Well, as I understand it, the decedent was very sick, and what he signed was basically blank change of beneficiary forms. Am I correct?
In yes, both Your Honor.
Cases. And so there wasn't any issue that this wasn't, I mean, it sounded like the experts agreed this was a signature, and there wasn't any issue as to the fact that he signed it willingly. He signed it. I think wasn't the issue before the court was what was his intent when he signed that, and what did he expect would be in that change of beneficiary form?
No, Your Honor.
And why not? I mean, well, because this isn't, I mean, the usual undue influence case is where someone convinces him to sign a document that's been fully filled out and saying, this is what it should say. Here we have someone else filling the document out after he signed it.
Well, first of all, the court found that the beneficiary form that would inure to the benefit of the respondents was also filled out not by the decedent. That was the way that the decedent went here. But I want to point out to the trial court's own conclusions of law. And the first one is that item six, that the about the signature. And then in conclusion seven, the court says it perhaps best. It used the definite article, the second issue identified the parties as a matter of dispute is whether or not he possessed sufficient capacity to understand and change the beneficiary designation forms. The words undue influence do not appear anywhere in the trial court record. They're not in the petition done by the respondents. They're not in any argument because the respondents didn't make an argument afterwards, and there was no questioning about it. What
Mr.
happened?
Westrick, can I just interrupt to ask
of
you
course.
Part of that same answer you just giving? It's also true, as I read the order multiple times that it's never mentioned in the order, neither in the findings nor the conclusions of law. And in fact, the judge's own words during the motion for amended findings was that, I believe the phrase was, he didn't make reference, it was not an undue influence case. So we have the judge's words afterwards. What I'm asking is, and I didn't see any citation in your brief to any law that would, the theory that we could somehow, in effect, from the findings that the court did make, come to a conclusion the court was concluding and finding there was undue influence. I'm just having a hard time. And I noticed the respondent's brief also mentions undue influence, but it just strikes me as a bit of an odd review for us to come to some conclusion that in effect, the court did something in effect without ever referencing it and actually somewhat disavowing it in the judge's own words.
And a finding that the last benefit, the questioned document, Exhibit 2, as it were, that document reflected the appellant's will and not the decedent's will can only be interpreted one way, and that is that is an undue influence. If one looks at the undue influence cases, that is language that is often used. So I'm aware that the trial court disavowed that is what he did, but in fact, that is what he did because he wasn't asked to do that. So Ms. Egan, of course, didn't present any evidence to try and show it. And had that been the issue, the respondents would have had the burden of proof. And quite frankly, they likely would have had it by clear and convincing evidence. Did I answer your question or not?
Well, in part, I'm not sure the answer of that phrase the judge made solves the issue for me, at least. And the reason I ask that or say that is that it seems like all the parties agree that the Brown test applies and that was the issue the trial court primarily was asked to resolve. And that is, what was the decedent's intent as to his beneficiary? And so it would seem that particular conclusion you're referring to is the question is, was it the decedent's intent or was it the petitioner's intent? And that would seem like a natural answer for the judge to resolve. And the judge did, of course, ultimately. But am I correct that the primary issue and everybody's agreeing that the Brown test should apply? And I'm assuming by that, Mr. Westrick, a signature alone does not resolve the conclusion for the district court, nor does it in our review.
No, but the Brown test, which we say since the court applied it, if one applies the Brown test, Molly Egan must prevail. And that's because the Brown test is clear, especially if you look at the cases before and after, that if there is some confusion as to what is the intent, but the signature is valid and you meet the other, then if there's confusion, the last designation is the one that wins. And so for the court to say, no, we're going to do this interim change. And remember, this was, as I point out, the distribution to the family members equally was a day-old process. This wasn't some established estate plan that had suddenly been modified as a result of, you know, all of these alleged machinations. I also want to make it clear, Your Honor, that one of the other problems here is that the court found, now while he used the term moderately with respect to my client, the court actually found all of the parties credible here.
Didn't he find with that your client's version of what occurred, that he didn't find her credible enough to support that was the decedent's intent when he signed that last change of beneficiary? So, I mean, and don't we, as a corollary to that, don't we as a reviewing court have to defer to the court's assessment of her credibility?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. Yes, as a sitting court of appeals, you have to defer to assessments of credibility. The issue here was, as presented by the respondents, were two issues, capacity and signature, not was this really his intent. And when you go to the Brown case, Once the signature's there, that's an objective. It could even be a mark. That's the objective sign of intent. And they would have had the burden to prove. And I'm just going to slide off on this because I'm still confused by the trial court's notion that somehow evidence that wasn't presented, that is, the evidence of the lack of cross-examination of one of the principal respondent, that somehow that lack of cross-examination is evidence that undermines my client's position. And I that was very confusing to me. I feel not only is it really a shifting of the burden, but I explained the logical fallacy in doing this. I mean, again, from our perspective, this is a very straightforward case. The issues were laid out by the parties. The court resolved the issues that were laid out by the parties that in a way that we believe means we should win. In other words, the conclusions that say that the respondents should get the distributions is incorrect because they do not flow from the issues as raised by the parties and the findings thereon. Yes, Judge Bradfold, I see you unmuted. So.
Yeah, I would like to hear, Mr. Westrick, from you on what I consider to be the district court's key analysis as to the change of beneficiary form that you are advocating. So on paragraph 27 at page 17 of the district court's decision, the district court spends quite some time discussing the factors and facts that lead it to question the veracity of the petitioner. So here the appellant's testimony about the decedent's expressed intent. And the judge gives four very specific reasons why on that issue. So as to the decedent's expressed intent and the signing of the second form on that issue, why her testimony was not credible. So on what basis would we overturn those four very specific findings?
Well, one, you would overturn them because they are somewhat contradictory to the court's other findings under the Brown test. If the court didn't believe that, as you've laid out and interpret conclusion or finding 27, whichever it is, then what happened is the court should have said, this doesn't meet Brown because this wasn't really signed. This wasn't the decedent. This was not the decedent's signature. I mean, what really happened?
I totally disagree with you, Mr. Westrick. I do not see that in the Brown decision. Brown asked the court to assess the decedent's intent. Both parties argue that Brown applies here, and the district court made very specific findings about the decedent's intent. And as to the form you are advocating, the change of beneficiary form, the judge rejected the appellant's testimony that that was his intent to designate her as a sole beneficiary the day after he had very explicitly told her that that was not his intent. So, you know, this immediate change one day later is obviously crucial to the facts of the case, and the district court rejected the appellant's testimony on it.
I would note that the immediate change was also one day before, but I understand where the court is coming from.
Isn't it one day after the other form? So form number two, isn't that right?
Yes, but my point is form number one, the earlier form was a change that had been done exactly one day before. Again, this is not a long-term, estate plan that was somehow upset. The original beneficiary designation was to go to one of the children solely and not to all of the children equally. And that was also done with my client there and the principal respondent being there. So the court also made a finding that Mr. Egan, the decedent, was quite upset to find certain information out. He actually found that was credible. And so, again, our view is that the Brown test lays out that you do intent by, I believe, your objective, not your subjective. The court found it was his signature. The court found he was competent. Those were the issues that the court was told to do. And then the court, when it applied the Brown test, did those. And once it found it was his signature, and once the court found he was competent, the court should have stopped because no one else raised these other issues. That's the problem that we have with what the court did. And then the other problem we have with what the court did was that it seemed to conflate the notion of equity with the notion of I can consider other things that the parties didn't raise, and a lack of evidence was somehow evidence. That's our principal argument here. And if there aren't any more questions, I'll quit until rebuttal. All right, thank you.
Mr. Downs?
Hi, good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Patrick Downs. I'm here on behalf of Leah Egan, who is present with me in the office, and one of the siblings, Matthew Egan, just so the court is aware of who is present here. I was not the trial attorney on this. The trial attorney is no longer practicing, so I've kind of come to this case a little bit late. But I've read Judge Gilligan's order quite a few times. Again, Judge Gilligan made findings based on the evidence and the testimony presented at trial. It's not unusual, it's not inappropriate for testimony and or evidence to raise issues that may or may not have been contemplated prior to the start of the trial. And it's not inappropriate or not unexpected that attorneys and parties would have to address issues they didn't contemplate. It doesn't change the law of the case. It doesn't change the case law. It doesn't change the statutory requirements. And again, it's up to the trial attorneys to make determination about what they do or don't want to respond to. The trial attorney's decisions to address an issue or not address the issue, I don't think are binding upon the court. If the court identifies an issue, I don't think it's, I don't have any prohibition for the courts to address an issue that's been raised, again, via testimony or the submission of evidence.
Mr. Downs, you mentioned undue influence also in your brief to this court, and I'll ask you the same question I did Mr. Westrick. I did not see any findings nor conclusions, and you trying to look at the factors for undue influence that were identified, even trying to fit those into any findings, and could not see any. I'm somewhat assuming by that the court, in the court's own words, that it was relying on intent and differentiated capacity, which the court found the decedent had capacity in any event. So would it be safe to say that we ought to presume, as the judge did and said, that there's no issue of undue influence for us to review, but that instead you agree, apparently, as everybody seemed to, and the judge understood, that the Brown issue is the issue, and that is the decedent's intent. So that's the review of the findings and the record that we make.
In my brief, on page 6, where I discuss in re the estate of Wilson, 27 Northwest 2nd, 429, I do discuss the factors of, you know, what undue influence is. And I think the court makes sufficient findings in its order that one could look at that, those factors, and come to the conclusion that there was undue influence, that was an issue or a factor in this case. Okay. As to the, I think everyone testified, and I think there was a general consensus that Mr. Egan at some point wanted to make a change to his beneficiaries. And at trial, there was multiple iterations of this beneficiary form that were provided. Again, I wasn't at the trial. I didn't set the issues. I think there was far too much emphasis placed on whether the signature was authentic. And again, assuming the signature was authentic, we get to the issue of, well, where do we find intent? The court made a finding that the first iteration, the first version of that, which did the sort of more global distribution between Miss Egan and the children, that was a clearer indication of Mr. Egan's intent. The further iterations, and again, all these iterations were not filled out by Mr. Egan. They were all filled out by third parties, Miss Egan. later iterations essentially moved further away to the point where they no longer represented the will or the intent of the decedent. And again, those are findings that are in Judge Gilligan's order. And there is a case, and I where it's the Lemke versus Schwartz. It's 286 Northwest 2nd, 693, which I reference in section two of my brief, which is, you know, there's case law that says, you know, if we have intent and we have a question as to what ultimately that intent was. I mean, the answer isn't that we just go to give all the proceeds to the appellant, which I think was where Mr. Westrick was arguing. The case law is we go back to the original distribution, the original intent, the original document. And in that original document, it read that all the proceeds were to go to Matthew Egan. So if we're looking at the test, we're looking at, well, if say we don't meet a part of the test, I don't think the answer is, well, we go with the final iteration and we give it all to the appellant. I think the Schwartz and Lemke tell us that we look to the last document that where we can match intent and we can match what Mr. Egan wanted to do. And that was not the document that I think that Mr. Westrick was referring to.
Mr. Downs, can I, my understanding of that indeed the issue of whether it was the decedent's signature was initially raised by your client. The court made findings and the experts essentially concluded that indeed it was his signature. And so I'm assuming in effect, and I think your client did not submit a closing argument in fact, so I assume, am I correct to imply from that the court's conclusion as to intent your client was satisfied with? In other words, the $80,000 to petitioner and the balance between the children equally.
I think there was I wasn't the trial attorney and I wish I had been there, but again, I think you're correct. I think there was a consensus that amongst all the people who testified that there was an intent to change and that the intent to change was the $80,000 to the appellant and then the division amongst the kids. I think there was a...
Thank you. So the point being is no document with a signature from your client's perspective was the intention. That's the judge's ultimate ruling because the two subsequent changes, neither of which identified the intent as the judge found and as your client ultimately then, as I understand, would agree to. My question is then the second part of the Brown test, and we're all again agreeing the Brown test applies. And I'm asking in particular because the judge in, I believe it's conclusion number 16 on page 14 of its order, in any event, the overall testimony suggests the decedent, though in decline, still possessed capacity to execute and understand any document he may have been presented on the evening of November 29. That document, the last of which you were referring to it, would give 100% to the petitioner. My question for you, how do we analyze the second part of the Brown test? If he has capacity, and which tells me he understood what he was signing, how does that square with the requirement that he take affirmative steps to undo essentially what he signed so that we can read an intention outside of what he signed if he has capacity to sign what he signed? And that would have been the 100% beneficiary form. How do we look in the record too? I guess a part of my question is where in the record would we look to answer that consistent with the court's order as well as the law?
I think you have to. So I look at this issue very narrowly, which is, okay, there was a moment when Mr. Egan signed that first iteration of the order or of the beneficiary change form. And again, I think there's capacity and that's his signature on that first iteration. I think the court, and I only have 5 minutes. I don't want to spend my last few minutes digging through, but I think the court makes a series of findings that says, as these changes were being made, that these changes were not necessarily within the purview or they were not necessarily, Mr. Egan was necessarily aware of them, that each iteration, including the final iteration, which wasn't faxed to AAA until after the decedent had passed, that each iteration moved further and further away from the initial intention and the initial desires of Mr. Egan, and that each iteration was a, I guess you could almost say, was a further substitute of somebody else's desires or somebody else's intentions for what that document ultimately, their, Mr. Westrick and the appellant say, evolved into. So the court, I'm sorry.
Mr. Downs, I appreciate your careful thinking about this issue, but I'm wondering, it seems to me that the district court's finding that the decedent signed these forms when they were blank. So that was mentioned earlier to appellant. And I see that finding as significant. Do you, in terms of application of the Brown test?
I do. And that, you know, and I think Tom was reading, it's like if I were to say to sign a blank sheet of paper and someone to put a confession on it, or if I were to sign a check and someone were to get hold of it and just start filling it out. I mean, we could have a really interesting debate about whether or not my signature was, you know, when I signed it, it was my signature. I was cognitive of what I was doing. I did it voluntarily. I mean, you could have this really long analysis, but ultimately, what's the difference between a signature and basically an autograph? I mean,
well, can I ask you this? Because as I just want to make sure I understand the facts, because the first form, as I understand it, there is actually, he announced to everyone, this is my intent. And so there were all these witnesses. So there was no dispute as to the first change of beneficiary form as to what the intent was. And if I understand the findings, then it was the appellant here who basically, notwithstanding that expressed intent, didn't do what he had indicated he wanted it to say. She didn't write that down. It wasn't that anyone influenced him, right, to come up with this scenario. It was that he expressed it, and then it just came down to how it was written down. So wasn't it, am I understanding that first change of beneficiary, those facts correctly?
Yes, like I said, Your Honor, I mean, there's a first iteration, then we have all these other multiple iterations. You know, three were faxed within 24 hours the next day, then we've got this, the final version.
But wasn't it the appellant that was in charge of putting all this down, this information down?
Correct.
And there were mistakes that she tried to correct and whatnot, but she left herself off, even though he made it very clear she was to get $80,000.
Yes. And again, I think the trial court goes through a finder. It discusses this, the different iterations, and how again, each iteration got further away from what the parties testified to was that intent and that desire when the first iteration was actually signed. And again, I will concede that the signature is legal and valid, and he was capable of signing a document at that time, but that's different than whether or not through those various iterations somebody else didn't put in a different intent or a different desire.
Well, and I know the court cites the Brown case in paragraph 4 in the conclusions of law, and says, and I'll just read it because it's one sentence. It's a determination of whether the decedent effectively changed the beneficiary of an insurance policy is governed by equitable principles, and the judge cites to Brown. Doesn't that tell us that the court is kind of authorized to do what is fair and equitable under these circumstances?
I think the court sitting in equity took the evidence of intent. There was no testimony from any witness that there wasn't an intent to make a change. I think the court then found the most reasonable contemporaneous expression, which was that first iteration and the testimony of the party saying, this is what at that, you know, contemporaneously with that signature, what was the intent? What did people here say? What did the most importantly, what did the decedent express? So I think the court tried to find that moment where those two things were as close as possible and then use that as the basis for his decision. And I see I have 20 seconds left. I don't know if anybody has any other questions, or otherwise I'll conclude.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Westrick.
Thank you, Your Honors. First thing I want to address is the notion that we should go back to everything goes to Matthew Egan. There was no notice of counter appeal or what we used to call a notice of review. So I don't know that that's really before the court. When Judge Slater referenced finding 16, that was what I thought I was expressing when I said that the final expression of the decedent's intent is his signature, and that when they talk about the overall testimony, he understood any document he may have been presented. And while the documents were signed in blank, there was testimony by everyone there that other people besides just the appellant were filling them out. That there were other people there for some of them, and they were being filled out. And so I'm not entirely sure that this is what we used to call fraud in factum kind of thing. There was no question. The real expression of his intent is his understanding and signature. There was also something referenced about the fax to AAA. That fact is irrelevant because once AAA paid into court, that how they got it or whether they got it or whether it was sufficient doesn't matter. And the last thing I want to really point out was that the trial court also made a finding that all of these documents, irrespective of whatever date they bear, were all signed on the same day, on November 29th. And that has importance with finding 16. If any member of the court has a question, I'll be happy to try and answer it. And if not, my client and I thank the court for its time and attention to the matter. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, counsel. It's a very interesting case. We will take it under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory period of time. But thank you for your arguments and your assistance in helping us address this matter. Thank you.